Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Pat Manning on the show, and we'll be discussing his new book, The African Diaspora, A History Through Culture. You've probably heard the word diaspora before. It is most often associated with Jews and the Jewish diaspora, but there have been many, many others. There is the Chinese diaspora, there is the Indian diaspora, and of course there's the subject of Professor Manning's book, The African Diaspora, and that is the spread of Africans all over the world. Africans have been moving all over the world for a very long time. In fact, one might say that they were the original out-migrants. Some 50 or 60,000 years ago, all of us, or the ancestors of all of us, left Africa. Pat deals with a much more recent diaspora or exodus, and that is the one that began roughly in 1400 and continues to this day. Of course, there's a large intermittent phase between about 1600 and 1900 that is bound up with the sad story of slavery, but there are a lot of other stories to tell about the African diaspora. I should also say that Pat Manning is one of the founders of World History, so it was a real honor for me to talk to him on those grounds alone. So without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
That's very good. You are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, one of my favorite cities.
And one of my favorite cities as well.
I imagine it is. How's the weather there?
Well, it's cloudy and cool today after being sunny and 80 degrees yesterday.
Oh, you're a lucky devil. No, it's quite nice. We have beautiful springs here in Iowa. They last about 2 days. They last a little longer. I should tell our listeners that we have Pat Manning on the show, and I'm really, really pleased to have him because he is someone who I have followed for many years since I entered history. He's also one of the founders of the field of world history. You don't get to talk to someone who founded a field very often. And he's written a wonderful new book called The African Diaspora, A History Through Culture. I don't really know anything about African history, to be honest with you. As I was telling Patrick in the pre-interview, my graduate program taught me to know everything there was about the 1670s in Russia. So not exactly broad, but so this is one of the reasons I do these shows and get to read these wonderful books. And I learned a lot about African history and the African diaspora within which we all live.
Some people from Africa who made it into Russia in the 60s.
Oh, yes, actually, I know about these people. I do know. Yes, so we'll talk about that. So, but Pat, why don't we begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you went to school, and how you founded World History. If that's not too much to say.
Well, I started life in Southern California and was an undergraduate in chemistry, actually, at Caltech, though interested in history as I went through that, and decided to head off to graduate school in the early 1960s at a time when African countries were getting independence. There was a lot of excitement about that, and so I went off to Madison, Wisconsin, to study history of Africa. And had one of those careers that started a little slow. I taught in community colleges for 13 years and then hopped around. And finally, by the 1980s, I ended up at Northeastern University in Boston, jointly appointed in history and African American studies. And my work was initially on economic history in Africa. I wanted to see economic history done in Africa at the same standard as in other places. And that led me into studies of the slave trade, which was a booming field in the 60s and 70s. By the beginning of the 1990s, I had convinced the department at Northeastern University that we should not only try to open a doctoral program in history, but focus it in the study of world history. So if I'm a founder in world history, it's not really as a founder of the field, but as a founder of graduate study in world history. My particular angle has been the importance of treating this as a research field and not just a teaching field. Mm-hmm. So from 1994 till the early 2000s, I had the pleasure of leading the World History Center at Northeastern University and directing a doctoral program in which nearly 15 people did studies and degrees in world history and got jobs that they still have. My research continued in the African history and African diaspora history, and then sort of wrapping that work up in, I published a 2003 book called Navigating World History, which is an overview of the field of historiography and conceptualization and research and methodology, and finally a section on graduate study in world history. Mm-hmm. The Northeastern program didn't make it. I'll just get into the long version of the story if I go into it at all. In any case, that slowed down. And in 2006, I had the opportunity to come to the University of Pittsburgh, which has been a wonderful fit for me. And we opened up a second and larger, and I think more successful, center in world history, opened in 2008, and we're just about ready to open up a doctoral program in world history.
Well, that's great. Congratulations on that. That's terrific.
Yeah.
I think all of us in the field followed the story and fate of the program at Northeastern with some interest, and I know that I think it's too bad they decided not to continue the program, but I'm very happy to hear that it's going to, I'm sure, prosper in Pittsburgh. So the one thing I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about is the identity of world history itself. What is it? I mean, I think people understand.
What is it?
Yeah, people understand exactly what German history is and Russian history. That's what I was trained to study, and so on and so forth, all these national histories. But what exactly is world history?
Right, and it can't be exactly what world history is because it's big enough, and so it goes in lots of different mm-hmm. directions. And that's why there are all these competing names for it: world history, global history, transnational history, international history, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And those subdivisions actually do mean things there.
Mm-hmm.
Most importantly, history at a large scale. Trying to find patterns that are discernible over large areas and long periods of time. So world history is most obviously about multiple spaces. So the history not just of North America, but of North America and Europe together. That's a kind of a familiar version, or indeed of the African diaspora, another hunk of the world. But world history is also long periods of time. So most of the history profession does focus on just the last two centuries. So your work in Russian history is kind of early stuff. even though Russian history goes way back before the work is done on recent times. So world historians are especially interested in earlier times or links between early and recent times. And then two more dimensions to this. It's different topics. So world history includes the interactions between economic and political history or cultural and social history. World historians aren't the only ones who do this, but there's a particular attention to how one aspect of life affects another. And this is what has developed in recent times. An understanding that world history is also about the relationship between different scales of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So not just the worldwide patterns, but the interaction between national and global history, or indeed the role of the individual in the world, or the world in the life of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So no one person can do all of those things, but the idea, as I see it, thinking in terms of graduate school, is that there is evolving a literature in world history that focuses on an explanation of the human experience overall, or the human experience overall in a few centuries, or the overall experience of the human economy, say, in the last five centuries, where the objective is to look at the big patterns, especially though, you know, each person will have their own special area within it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm so glad to hear the phrase.
That's
terrific. I was just saying, I was so glad to hear the phrase. It's sort of the history of humanity as a totality. I don't remember exactly how you put it, but I think this is something that is sorely needed because, graduate programs in history, for all that they make you take a couple of introductory classes and stuff outside your field, are very segmented. Most things are stovepipe, so that the German historian doesn't know what to say to the Latin American historian, and the Latin American historian has no idea what to say to the Japanese historian. And I think this is largely a function of the way we conceive of valuable historical work, and publishers have conceived of it. So I know that in my own case, as again we talked about this in the pre-interview, I wrote my books and articles on early modern Russian history, but then I kind of felt I knew enough about early modern Russian history. Quite honestly, I satisfied my curiosity, and I was ready to do something else. And I remember when my department said this a long time ago, you know, what's your next monograph on early modern Russian history going to be? And I'm like, I'm not going to write another one. I'm going to go do something else now. And I think everybody has that sense that they want to move into another direction, but it's just not, it's not really allowed very much. So I could say that not only did I study the 16th century, but now I'm trying to work on very long periods of time in my own work. I'm working on the evolution of human nature and initial hunter-gatherers. I'm sure big story like that. So
yeah,
I'm a big fan of world history. I also think it rises above all the sort of sectarian infighting that we have, because when you really do look at the big picture, it's pretty humbling in a way. It's pretty humbling. So in any event, I applaud you for your work. Let me ask you this. How did you come to write The African Diaspora?
How did I come to write The African Diaspora? Well, I was approached by a publisher's representative who said, why don't you write a book on the history of the African diaspora? I dragged my feet and thought about it for a year, and ultimately decided to go along with it, because it's an opportunity to pull together and try to make a statement about all the different areas in which I have worked over time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had worked, you know, primarily as a historian of Africa, but also done research on transatlantic slave trade, but then with that, slave trade in multiple directions, and then an interesting project on Louisiana and had training in multiple disciplines. So area studies work in African history, gave one stuff in anthropology and sociology as well. And so it's an attempt to try to tell that overall story.
Mm-hmm.
So that process started in 2000 or maybe even 1999. So it took me quite a while to get it finished up. but I knew right away the basic way in which I wanted to organize the book, which was that it was to include the African continent, that is to say, not just to be about the New World diaspora, but to include the African continent, and also what I've come to call the Old World African diaspora, the movement of Africans into Europe and different parts of Asia and the Indian Ocean. And second, I knew that I wanted to organize it in chronological terms, that rather than present regional chapters and then do an accumulation of regional stories, that I would try in each time period that I identified to look at the interconnections amongst regions and see if there are some larger patterns that emerge that might have been previously a little harder to see, but that appear when you review this whole region for a couple centuries or a century.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I did find a few things that I thought were new ways of looking at things that came from looking at that breadth.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty rapidly, I came up with the subtitle, A History Through Culture. Now, I'm not a cultural historian. I'm an economic historian. I have the gut impulses of a social scientist. looking at cause and effects, and I've had to learn to think about feedback and so forth. But I wanted to focus on an interplay of cultural affairs, along with the political and economic and social history. That's sort of the core of the history of enslavement and emancipation and struggles for entry into political participation. That's the most obvious narrative for the African diaspora. So the particular emphasis is that in these stories about black people in Africa and in other regions, usually in slavery, we're short on things in the voice of Africans. So now we have tons of stuff that's written in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, literature in Africa and throughout the Americas is just spinning out in great quantities, song lyrics and so forth. But for earlier times, we're short on verbal stuff. But if we look at the material culture and the expressive culture, the religious practices, the dress, all the things that people make and do, we can try to get from that responses of the people at every stage and in every place in the unfolding of the diaspora, the representations that people gave to world that they lived in, and in some sense be in a dialogue with the people of the past as we look from the present.
I was going to say
that, and just to tell you one particular struggle that I faced on that, because a big thing for me was images for the book, and I wanted the images, insofar as possible, to be things that were created by the people of Africa and the African diaspora. And I found that it's so many of the standard images that one would get are images made by Europeans or by people outside the African and diaspora community. And so the images that I have are, in a certain sense, not the most arresting ones or the best known ones. But it's been an interesting exercise for me to really try to develop in visual terms, the way in which people of the African diaspora have looked at themselves and their world.
That's very interesting. Let me ask a couple of what may seem like a bit naive questions, I guess, but I know that I'm interested. One of the challenges that I face whenever I start a project is when to start and what to include. And in this case, these challenges seem almost insurmountable because African history is the oldest among human histories. So where to begin is a difficult. People have been leaving Africa for what is it now 60,000 years, so makes it somewhat problematic. And then Africa itself is a very large place and it's very diverse. So maybe you could just talk about those two things. When do you begin and what to include?
Right. So the narrative in the book begins in the first chapter is conceptual organization of the materials, and so the narrative begins in the second chapter, and it really begins in 1400, year 1400, though there is a background section on the language and cultures and the social structures of Africa, but I chose not to try to, from 1400 to 1600, you can talk about both the African continent and the diaspora regions to the east and to the west of the continent. And I wanted to convey a picture of change in Africa. What were the debates? And I chose as the main debate the question of an evolving hierarchy and how people, encourage and limited hierarchy there. At the same time as systems of African immigrant populations, especially in slavery, were growing in the other places. So that was my stage one, and then that ends in a time of right about 1600, when enslavement becomes really a large scale issue for people on the continent and abroad, and so then the time from 1600 to 1800 represent as a struggle for survival, and then we go on after that. But in any case, I had therefore to schematize and boil down my presentations of the language and culture groups and the geography of different parts of the continent. So the way that I tried to deal with the problem of the huge area and the diversity was just to keep returning to the continent all the way through the narrative and returning to different parts of the continent, and to make it so that if anybody, for instance, wanted to do a narrative of East Africa by picking out little segments of the book, you could use the index and do that. It's a subordinate theme, it was interesting to try to keep alive a little bit of the story of each corner of the African and diaspora world over 600 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize how diverse this place is. It's very large and very diverse, both in what we might call socioeconomic terms. There are people that, you know, with all sorts of different ecologies. There's, I don't know how many languages, zillions of languages. People, really a remarkably diverse place. Let me ask another a little bit more challenging question. I don't know, in my mind, there seems to be this distinction. When I think of Africans, I think of sub-Saharan people. I don't know why I do that, because I guess the Egyptians are every bit as African as anybody else by the continental standard. But how did you deal with that sort of, I guess, imposed distinction?
Well, I've lived and worked at this stuff long enough to watch the cycle go back and forth. You know, when I was trained at Wisconsin in the 60s, we organized in fully continental terms, and that was the time when the Organization of African Unity was being formed. So both in contemporary and past terms, that was a way of looking at it. And then I watched as the division began to be made more in racial terms, or what we understood nowadays to be racial terms. And so North Africa got left out for a long time. And now we're getting at a time when both on the continent and in appreciation of the continent from outside, people are looking at it as a whole unit. I chose to focus on Africa, quotes, as the sub-Saharan homeland. Mm-hmm. And then I spent a lot of time on a map that's up in the front of the book that distinguishes the homeland from the various groupings of the diaspora. Mm-hmm. And North Africa, also Arabian Peninsula, and also Madagascar are the three areas which I call the near diaspora. Mm-hmm. Those are the places right cheek by jowl with sub-Saharan Africa, where the largest numbers of migrants went back and forth in both ways, where the continuing survival of sub-Saharan African culture and political practice is most evident, and so forth, and which are actually understudied. Mm-hmm. And then the other parts, the rest of Eurasia, really, and the Americas, I call the far diaspora. Mm-hmm. The experience of the book made me feel the need to spend a lot more time learning about North Africa and Arabia as parts of the African experience. And I'm pointed in that direction. That now we'll see how far I get.
Mm-hmm. Russians have a great expression for just the concept you're talking about. They talk about Russia and then the near abroad.
Yeah.
I really like that, the near abroad.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the near, I guess you call it the near diaspora, or is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, the near diaspora. Let's talk a little bit about that. And the movement of African, subcontinental Africans to the north, I guess. Why did they go? Under what impetus did they move?
Well, trade initially, had people moving in both directions. So there's a substantial gold trade where the gold was in West Africa and the Niger Valley and heading up to the Mediterranean, and salt going from the Sahara in both directions, and horses going from north to south. A lot of trade along the Red Sea, so that Ethiopia was linked to Egypt and Syria and so forth, and for that matter to India. So those commercial ties are always there, but it became the proportion of it that was focused on moving people in slavery from south to north grew.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly and steadily, the documents are not, you know, not quite so. The peak in that slave trade was in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
But it went way back to certainly to the 6th century. And really, you know, if you think back to Greek and Roman times, a certain number of the slaves there were from the Nile Valley as well as mm-hmm. other parts of the world around mm-hmm. the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
So this long experience of people being brought in, either sold individually as slaves or, in case, you know, sometimes captured in wars, like the wars up and down the Nile Valley.
Mm-hmm. One question I had, which had reference to the Russian experience, I happen to know that you often find Russians in, I wanted to say Arab, but really Muslim captivity, because Muslims cannot enslave other Muslims, but they don't mind slavery so much. So they would slave raid into Russian territories in the 13th and 14th century. And since the caliphate controlled the northern Mediterranean, I think, at this period, were they sending detachments of people to gather up slaves? And also, one of the other things I realize is that in the Russian case, they were able to gather a lot of slaves because the Russians refused to convert. But the but there were lots of African peoples that adopted Islam at this time. This is when Africa is Islamized, or at least a large portion of it. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, the process of Islam making its way into sub-Saharan Africa starts from the 7th or 8th or 9th century, I guess, and slowly spreads on. You know, it really accelerates in the 19th century, but it's you know, it's steadily advancing throughout the time from shortly after when Islam was founded. You know, some of the African slaves were, especially once the Ottoman Empire got going, right? So 14th and 15th century, they're moving people all around the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. So this is one of the ways in which a certain number of people of African origin got to Abkhazia on the eastern Black Sea coast. You know, by the same reasoning, Russian and other Slavic captives must have been moved all around the Mediterranean.
Well, they were. We know. You have lists of them, and you can see that the names are they're basically East Slavic names, and these are clearly Russians that have been sold into slavery or been captured and sold into slavery by other Russians. We don't really know how it transpired. There's almost no documentation. This situation is quite parallel in that way because we only see it from the Ottoman side. Or from, in this case, the Safavid side, you know, the Iranian side. The Russians are mute, basically, about all this. But we see their names in lists, so we know that they were serving in the Ottoman court and in the Safavid court. So I guess it's parallel in that way. Were African traders well known? I mean, we think of the Renaissance, for example, as a period of great and growing trade in the Mediterranean and other places. Were African traders known among, you know, Genoese traders and this kind of thing?
Although they weren't, you know, African-led expeditions and so forth. So let me think about this. The question is a great one. We don't have documents that I can think of. African merchants who have headed off from someplace like Mali or Nubia and gone to, you know, as far as Istanbul or Venice and so forth. We have plenty of stories of priests or people from the clergy from Ethiopia who go over this large area. And the African merchants that I know of documented remained on the African continent. There's this tremendous treasure trove of Arabic language documents that's being uncovered in and around Timbuktu.
Uh-huh.
You know, these come from as early as the 15th century and right on up to the 19th century, and families held on to these documents for a long time. And then in the last decade or so, they've been passing them on to libraries, and they're building these, you know, libraries just the way they ought to be, everything cataloged and made electronic copies of everything and put in proper air conditioning and so forth. And
I hope, there's some enterprising history undergraduates listening to this, because you should contact Professor Manning about about a really bang up dissertation. Learn some Arabic and go to Timbuktu. It sounds like a terrific.
And the cosmopolitan nature of the region, the things that they knew about from all over the world, are come clearly out of those things that I've seen reported from those documents.
I see. Well, let's move forward a little bit in time to the actual slave trade itself.
Yeah.
Why did I've always wondered about this. Why did Africa become the locus of the slave trade when the slave trade got going, so to say?
It's in the course of the 17th century that African slavery becomes the dominant aspect of slavery. African slavery, where people are held and put to work in the Americas, that becomes the dominant part of slavery worldwide. Before that, you know, slavery was a whole bunch of different people, especially in the Mediterranean and then all the way to Iran and India, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the development of the Atlantic plantation economy, an economy which began in the 16th century and as soon as the Europeans got to the Americas, but that really took hold, especially if you think of the Dutch and their expansion in the 1600s and attempt to seize the whole of the Portuguese Empire and as much as they could get of the Spanish, and the effectiveness of their big boats and just good skills at making commercial deals and setting up sugar plantations that expanded and developed a market for selling the sugar in Europe. This is when the flows of captured people across the Atlantic really become systematized. And then it's also the time when the Dutch and the English and the French are becoming much more important in commerce every place in Europe and the world. And in a way, the beginnings of the slave trade were cutting edge of that. You know, they had to learn all kinds of things about managing, carrying such large numbers of people and trying to keep them alive across long voyages.
Mm-hmm.
It's the expansion of the Atlantic economy in the European economy. But as we look at this in more world historical terms, we'll see broader connections because, for instance, most of the goods exchanged for African captives were textiles from India. So Indian textiles were shipped all the way to Amsterdam or Lisbon.
Wow.
And then sent back to the African coast. The reason for going indirectly was partly just the nature of the winds. It was not easy to sail directly from India to West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That time period is the big expansion of slavery for Africa, the big expansion of slave populations for the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
You have to mention the fact that a population of the Americas had collapsed to just tiny populations as a result of disease, especially in the, you know, by 1650 was a sort of a low point in American populations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
So bringing in workers from outside.
Yeah, exactly. I understand the what you might call demand side of the equation, which is to say these Europeans found themselves in possession of a lot of land, which they incidentally had stolen, of course, and decimated the native populations. And this land was reasonably fertile and had material endowments, and they didn't have people to work it. But I don't really understand the supply side very well. And you talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's not as if you could sort of tool into a Portuguese port and say, I'd like some slaves. But in Africa, apparently, you could do that. And I don't really understand how And again, this may seem like a completely naive question that every Africanist knows. How did they get the slaves? Yeah.
One big portion of the debate is the argument that John Thornton had made especially popular, that Africa was full of slaves, that there were a lot of people already there in slave positions, and that they could just, they were being sold back and forth anyhow. They could be sold to the Europeans, and so no big change. I think the reason I think that's wrong is because the difference between the number of people enslaved in the 16th century and in the 19th century is so great that you have to acknowledge that slavery expanded greatly in that interim. Nonetheless, it is the case that, as you said, your merchants were able to sail into towns and, after a bunch of haggling and so forth, come up with a load of people in slavery. There were hierarchies where some people were dependents of others, not necessarily enslaved, but enslavement involves, you know, somebody shifting the rules. So as a legal issue, you know, African societies had laws recognizing and protecting the rights of people that were free. And on the other hand, when you captured somebody, you could make the legal system grow, change, and all of a sudden somebody has lost all the rights that they had. Now, there were lots of efforts of families to ransom people who had been captured. If they could find news of somebody in, from their family had been captured, they'd go try to buy them back. But the social fragmentation and the divisions between political units made it so that there were wars going on and there were captives, and these tiny numbers of captives that were carried off at first began to build a system. And so it's hard to I mean, there's so many dimensions of this, but just to continue with this part of it, the basic ability of the European visitors to pay a price that was high enough that you could always find somebody, some thug, it seems to me, who would capture people and sell them and get rich from that, and then from that position of wealth be able to propagate the system, meant that at various times when people would rebel and overthrow the slave traders within Africa, what do you do with the people you've captured? Well, the temptation is to sell them. And so it's difficult to get out of the system as it grows.
I mean, in a way, my question really is a naive one, and I'm sure one of my listeners will point this out, because this process is still going on today. There are, I guess, millions of slaves in the world today. I read that there are more slaves alive today than were ever past the Middle Passage. So people are still selling one another. They're still finding the slaves. They're still supply and demand. Let me ask you a question about the Middle Passage.
Can I just interrupt?
Go ahead,
on,
please,
before
absolutely.
We get the next question on that point, because this is one of the things that really has been learned in the course of the last 30, 40 years of study about slavery. When I was amongst those working on this in its earlier stages, there was the idea that once the state comes out against slavery, you can repress it and it'll be gone. Okay, and so there was a lot of complaint because the European states in Africa did not liberate all the slaves right away, and that was part of the problem. But what we know now is that enslavement is something that gets reinvented time and time again. And so we're watching its expansion nowadays. So that gives a new understanding of the sort of proclivity to enslave, which is always there, and then sometimes it gets totally out of hand, like now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. That is, there is something in us that wants to do it. I don't know how else to say it, because it does recur and recur and recur, even among really right-thinking people, like the people that founded this country, who we think of as, you know, very bright folks who are on the right side of most everything. And they were even a little bit confused about the question as to whether it would be a good or bad thing to enslave Africans. And that has to be sort of remarkable to anybody who thinks about the founding of our country. But they were confused. We're not. At least most of us aren't. But there are people in the world who are. Again, I wanted to go back to the middle passage for just a second before we move on to a little bit more positive times for the Africans and their diaspora. I wanted to ask a question about it. I think a remarkable fact in the book, and I didn't know this at all. I knew that the middle passage was horrific, that, you know, something a quarter of people who went on it, or 14-15% changes, die. But almost the same percentage of crew members died on this passage. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah. So, and it's disease in each case. Now, the crew members are on board ship for a longer time period than the captives. But malaria especially, but, you know, dysentery and scurvy and so forth. So, you know, even in the better days of the late 18th century, 10%, 15% of the captives and a slightly larger percent of crew are failing to survive. Crew members include people who are African-born or African-descended as well. It was a deadly business.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. I was astounded. I read that passage out loud to my wife because I could hardly believe it. That is rough duty. Yeah. You know, you sign into a ship and there's a pretty much a 1 in 5 chance you're not going to make it.
That is
tough. So, which isn't, of course, to say that it wasn't far worse for the people who were below decks, because it was. So let's move on past the growth of the slave system into the era of its official dismantling. That is the 19th century. Maybe you could tell that story.
Well, the 19th century seems to me to have been an immensely complicated time, in that in one side of it is the growing and worldwide campaign for emancipation of slaves, which succeeds in the Americas it succeeds first in Western Europe and then in the Americas and then gradually in other parts of the world. But at that same time, slavery was still expanding. So Cuba and Brazil in the Americas, and then all over the African continent, and then to a lesser degree in Asia and the Indian Ocean, slavery was expanding during the 19th century. But then the third point is, as emancipation takes place, the development of free communities of color. So there were always a lot of free black people in the Americas, especially in the Spanish and Portuguese territories, but really everywhere. But their ability to build communities and try to buy more land and start education programs and start political programs, Pan-Africanism as the broadest part of that, is the third big part of the 19th century. And then all of this taking place at the time when Europe's imperial strength is growing, and where industrialization is transforming the economies of place after place, even in Africa. Not that the industrial production was there, but that industrially produced goods become important in Africa. Now that complicated enough to make it so that it's not a neat story. But the part that I want to emphasize is that the slavery part of it continues for quite some time.
Yeah, we were talking to a Brazilian historian recently, and I had no idea that slavery lasted as long as it did, or was as important as it was in Brazil. Brazil was the largest slaveholding country in the Western Hemisphere in the 19th century.
At least, yes, indeed.
Yes, that's right. So another thing I'm really interested in, and I've talked several times with people on the show about this, is the initiative that the Africans, or then African Brazilians or African Americans, I don't know what to call them, the slaves or ex-slaves, their initiatives in setting up communities of their own. And the reason I mention this is I grew up near one of them, or the remnants of one of them, a place called Nicodemus in Kansas, which was a black settler community. It was largely gone by the time that I remember seeing it. But I think that it's important to recognize that the Africans themselves showed lots of initiative in attempting to create an African culture, an African-American culture in the confines of this greater sort of racial hegemony. Maybe you could talk about those kinds of efforts for a second.
Well, of course, there's Maroon communities, communities that have escaped slaves. Yeah, exactly. So that's one part of it. But there's the church communities. There's the creation of this set of universities in the U.S. right at the time of the Civil War and after it. So Wilberforce and what's now Lincoln University and Morehouse and Hampton and Howard. No place else in the world except certain European schools could black people gain higher education. So that's one such thing. And it involves, those involved all white-black cooperation with its ups and downs. But that's an important part of the story throughout, but especially at that time. The equivalent educational institutions in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and high schools in Nigeria are developing also in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. So there's interesting parallel all around the world as this is a time when in Latin America, where there's a certain amount of civil war and the newly independent countries there, black men commonly volunteered for military service because they, you know, believed in the particular side with which they were affiliated, but also because military distinction was a way to gain social advance and recognition and confirm that they would be free rather than slave. Mm-hmm. And so out of this, a number of the main military leaders and several political leaders and presidents and vice presidents of countries were of African descent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's about at this time, near the end of the 19th century, I think, we'll move forward in time to the period where we discuss the not emancipation, but citizenship, that we find, and one of the most fascinating things to me, we've interviewed a couple of people on this show, one who wrote a terrific biography of Marcus Garvey, is the question in the black diaspora community about what to do, and to put it in the simplest terms, to stay or go. And I find this just really it's interesting because kind of the same thing was happening in the Jewish community at the time. Where should we live exactly? Maybe you could talk a little about that.
Where should we live and how should we live? Because racial discrimination is reaching an unprecedented peak. So people are free now and have the possibility of moving. But on the other hand, where different types of discrimination and just expressions of hatred are reaching a peak. Movements from Brazil to West Africa were actually, it began in the 1830s and 40s, so that's a little earlier for this. If I can change the question a little bit, what has struck me is not so much the migration of peoples, but the cultural responses to the high pressures of the time. So, because black people are being driven out of political office every place in the world in the 1890s. So in Africa, you know, the regimes are losing power. In the Americas, people are no longer elected to any office. But it's at this time that an astonishing cultural creativity shows up. Lift Every Voice, the Negro National Anthem, was written in the first decade of the 20th century. And all sorts of, you know, so in America we tell the stories of jazz and blues arising at this time, but in other parts of the world, all the Cuban and Trinidadian and Ghanaian and Moroccan forms of music that became key later on developed at this time. So what struck me as coming out of the communities was that the communities were celebrating themselves, strengthening themselves, and producing cultural forms that were interesting not only to the community, but increased their prestige with people around them. Mm-hmm. And so that the cultural creativity of that really dark time did a lot to strengthen the social relations and ultimately the political position of black people in country after country.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing we need to be careful to do, especially during this period, is not to homogenize the black groups in the diaspora. And I'm thinking particularly of a story that this fellow who wrote the biography of Marcus Garvey, who was from the islands, tells. And apparently Garvey decided, after moving to New York from the islands, to take a trip to the American South.
Uh-huh.
And Garvey was amazed and shocked by what he saw. Namely, he was shocked by the deference that black people showed white people.
Yeah.
Because where he was from in the islands, that didn't happen. Because not at all. Because there were 99 black people for every one white person. So it just didn't happen. And he really was shocked. He couldn't believe it. And so, you know, you see this differentiation among these communities themselves. Garvey is sort of one of my heroes in a weird sort of way, because he's largely forgotten as an American figure, or thought to be a buffoon. But having read this biography, I'm just very impressed by the guy. And really, these movements toward either it was a return to Africa or some sort of black liberation or creating your own community,
yeah,
it was a period of tremendous vibrancy within the diaspora.
So diaspora, Garvey's interesting as an artisan. He's trained as a printer and a newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. His father was a printer. Yeah.
And his movement really got kicked off, really grew in response to the race riots of American cities in 1917, 18, and 19. And so there were angry black people, because the race riots in those days were white people coming in and tearing up the black community, trying to drive people out of the cities that they'd come to inhabit. And so angry people joined up in this nationalist organization. And newspapers went all over the world. So there was without access to formal political institutions, with the newspapers being illegal in most places, an astonishing network of Pan-African thoughts right around the world.
It's kind of interesting. I hate to interrupt with almost a sort of what may seem to some people to be a kind of controversial point, but this interchange and exchange of ideas in the Jewish diaspora community has been studied very extensively. I mean, on this very show, we have interviewed 5 or 6 people who have devoted their entire careers to it. And I think in the African case, it just hasn't been studied extensively. I'm sure my listeners will write me and tell me that I'm full of it. But, I just having read your book and the Garvey biography, there's a very rich vein to be mined in terms of really serious diasporic discussion among black people about what they should do. There's probably tons of intellectual biographies and histories to be written about this. So get to it, people. No.
Go ahead.
My response at the end of it is that, you know, to realize that in all the big histories of the modern world, black people are left out.
Yeah, that's basically true.
They're given a footnote. There's a footnote for slavery and a footnote for emancipation and a footnote for decolonization and civil rights. But so that tells you that the story of modernity is done from the elite perspective.
Yeah, that's true.
Because black people didn't get to be elite. For a long period of time, they were simply systematically removed from elite positions. And so that the whole history that we do underemphasizes the way in which the part that I tried to tell most is in which cultural development bubbles up from communities and has its influence. But also, if you think about economic work or even techniques of political activism, those are stories that, because they're undervalued, have not been told, and that's the dimension. I mean, so it's not simple racial discrimination that eliminates Africa from these histories of the world, but it's what type of history we want to do. So I've become a big fan now of world history from the bottom up. I'm an explorer. what we can do with it.
Well, I mean, I certainly think it's the case, again, not to become too political or anything like that. I mean, I think that we should applaud good work that's done wherever it is done. And in the case of the Jewish diaspora, people have done absolutely fantastic work, and God love them for it. But it's largely because they have had the institutional support which is necessary in order to do that. I mean, there's usually a chair in Jewish history at every major university. I don't know how many chairs there are in African or diasporic studies or in history. I mean, there's the occasional African American study center or something like this. But, you know, nonetheless, in order to do our work, historians need support. And the fact of the matter is that this work hasn't been supported very, very, very well. So those of you who are listening who have very large checkbooks, send Pat a check and he'll put your money to good worth or good use. So I wanted to talk in this final segment about the period which I think that most of the listeners will know most about, and that is the period you call equality from 1960 to the present. And this is the moment at which the civil rights movement gets going and something approaching equality is achieved. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the premise of the section is that by 1960, people in Africa and the diaspora had achieved citizenship, formal political rights, mm-hmm. and the search now was for more general equality. But what do you mean, equality? Does equality mean giving up your own identity to become the same as everybody else? Is it economic equality? Is it cultural equality? So big disputes on this issue. Amongst the things I noted is that in that time period from 1960 to 2000, there were astonishing advances in the levels of education in black populations in Africa and overseas. That's one big thing. Another thing is really remarkable improvements in health conditions. So the African expectations of life were at about 35 years in 1960, and were pretty close to 50 years in 2000. So that's that's still low on a global comparison, but as a change within the continent, it's huge. And then on the other hand, the AIDS epidemic, which is really concentrated on the African continent, has actually reduced expectations of life for overall populations, mm-hmm. Most of the way back to where they were in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
The positive side of the move to equality is the just dramatic changes that you see in sport. So if you think of soccer as an example, where soccer players are spread all around the world, that all the European teams have lead figures who were born in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Just the change in basketball and football in the U.S. are such examples. The place of black people in popular culture is, sort of stunning in terms for the U.S., where mm-hmm. 10% of the population plays such a role in popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you go back to the 30s and 40s, you realize, whatever people were paid in those days, there was a substantial, leadership role of black artists in those times. So those are things where you see big changes, moves towards equality, and on the other hand, economic inequality, despite the improved health and educational conditions, has gotten worse. On a comparative basis, mm-hmm. at least in the U.S., in most of the Americas, and in absolute basis, in many parts of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So one is left with a dilemma.
Yeah, I see. We should probably, before we close the show, say that the African diaspora has hardly ceased. I mean, I know just even here at the University of Iowa in the middle of the United States, we have lots of African students who come here, and most of them actually return to Africa, but they come and stay with us for a while, and we're very happy to have them. So anybody thinking about graduate education in Africa should listen to me and apply. There are still Africans going all over the world now.
Oh yeah, no. The number of migrants, poor people struggling desperately to get into Europe to find work, on one hand, and highly educated professionals moving wherever they want. At the other end.
Yeah.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and thank you for telling it. We've taken up a ton of your time, and I really appreciate it. It's such an honor to talk to you. Let me close the interview with our traditional final question here on New Books in History, and that is, Pat, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
What am I working on now? Too many things. Building the World History Center. A book on African population, where I'm using the simulation techniques that I used before, and the results will show a much larger African population for the period from 1650 to 1900 than has been expected. I'm writing a textbook in world history. Finally, worked up my courage to do that. I have a new book coming out on the era 1989 to 91, a world historical view of that time period aimed at undergraduate students. And I have a long-term research project with a co-worker, Chris Arrett of UCLA, where we're going to do a history of early humanity. A historian's take on the times from early Homo sapiens on the African continent up until about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, and look at material from all the different disciplines to try to tell the story of migration and community growth.
I see. Well, all those sound fantastic, and I hope you get some sleep. That's a lot of irons in the fire. So anyway, I should tell our listeners we've been talking to Pat Manning about his terrific new book, The African Diaspora, A History Through Culture. Pat, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Pat Manning about his new book, The African Diaspora, A History Through Culture. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.